And Rodney has a PhD in physics from Oregon State University, and he's been an industrial physicist all his life and is retired from IBM now. He's the author of the book Reading Genesis 1 and the booklet Genesis 1 in the Age of the Earth, and also the ASA paper RATE Project, the claims about helium and zircon. So here he is here. Now you're all set up?
I'm all set.
Okay, then I turn this off.
Well, I'm going to use that. Okay, all right. Okay. Well, good afternoon. The fourth creative day of Genesis has been a confounding factor for those reading the first 35 verses of the Bible. English and Greek translations are typically read as indicating the creation of the sun and moon in Genesis 1:16, when planet Earth already exists, having land, seas, and plants on the land. Critics of the Bible point to the known natural history of the universe and term the Bible's making of the sun and moon and stars on the fourth creative day an absurdity. This, they assert, indicates that the Bible contains error. Gleason Archer, an editor of the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, asserted the verb asaw, used in Genesis 1:16, referred to the creation event of Genesis 1:1. Today, I will present grammatical evidence that the creation account of Genesis chapter 1 contains a number of structured, pluperfect references to events described and completed prior to the making of that reference. By this I mean that the wa consecutive Hebrew verb, vayas, in Genesis 1:16 is properly translated had made. Meredith Klein, advocating a two-register framework view, also interpreted the verb asaw as referring to a prior making. But he considered this to indicate a return to the first creative time, giving more detail. Now, there's much to get done in a short period of time, so we need a roadmap. And so this is how we will proceed. I will provide grammatical information needed for understanding the translation of Genesis 1:16. And then I'll answer the question, does the Hebrew grammar indicate the translation, and God had made, or the translation, and God made? Then third, I'll answer the question, did the writer of Genesis consider the words bara and the word asah to be different or equivalent? So, to say something first about the nature of the Hebrew language, what I wish to say is biblical Hebrew does not have tense. I'll have some references for that in a moment. But what is tense? Tense in English means that the form and the placement of verbs tell the reader the when of the actions, the sequence of the actions, and sometimes the duration of the actions. Not all languages have tense. Chinese is a language which is described as not having tense. But a speaker of Chinese can tell you the when of an action, the sequence, often the duration of the actions, but they do not do that by the verb form. So in our case, what we're going to want to be interested in is how does Hebrew tell us those things without using the verb form? So here I have a reference from Kennett. It was on the first page of his short account of the Hebrew tenses. And it says, what is tense? The name tenses, as applied to Hebrew verbs, is misleading. The so-called Hebrew tenses do not express the time, but merely the state of the action. On that same page, he goes on and says something at the beginning of that, which is in red, which is important for us today. And that is, it must always be borne in mind that it is impossible to translate a Hebrew verb into English without employing a limitation with respect to time, which is entirely absent in the Hebrew. And that, of course, is our problem, because we are interpreting out of the English text. So going forward, here we have the six verses of the fourth creative time. And you can see in the English, they all start "and." The "and" is the letter "wa," which is now shown on the screen in red. And you can see all these verbal forms begin with "wa." Now, the one we're interested in is Genesis 1:16, because the typical translation says "and God made." And what we are asserting is this "wa" consecutive verb, which is normally used in a continuous story for events that follow in sequence, should be translated "and had God had made." So let's go see what Gleason Archer actually said. He says the Hebrew verb "vayas" in verse 16 should be better rendered "now God had made the two great luminaries," rather than the simple past tense. And he goes on and says, "Hebrew has no special form for the pluperfect tense, but uses the perfect tense, or the conversive imperfect," that's this form, "as here, to express either the English past or the English pluperfect, depending on context." Now, this is an opinion. How do we go beyond opinion? How could we determine that "and had made" is the correct translation? So we can go to J.R. Driver's observation of annexing the particulars by the same means, and we will see that in a moment. Then we can go to temporal overlay, which is number 2, which is the repeat of many of the same words in the following sentences. This is lexical reference. Then there's a third one that actually exists only in Genesis 1, and that is a pluperfect marking indicated by bracketing the reference between the phrase "and it was so" and the phrase "and God saw that it was good." There are 4 examples of this bracketing in Genesis 1 which allow verification of the pattern of the group. So here we have Driver, and this is from 1881, and he starts out saying, "But the chronological sequence, though the most useful, is not the sole principle by which the use of "wa" is regulated." Well, later on in this same thing, he says something that's more important for our case. He says, "Or again, in describing a series of transactions, he will hasten at once to state briefly the issue of the whole." So our problem is to determine, has the writer of Genesis stated the issue of the whole? And then a Driver goes on and says, "Afterwards, as though forgetting that he had anticipated, proceed to annex the particulars by the same means." Here he's talking about using a "wa" consecutive verb as a "here," but he's not changing the word order. In neither of these cases is it implied that the event introduced by the "wa" is subsequent to that denoted by the previous verb. So we have to determine what the previous verb is. So we're going to go forward and look at this. Did the author of Genesis satisfy Driver's issue of the whole? And we see it starts out in 1:14 and says, "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament, and that is to divide the day from the night, and is to be for signs, seasons, days, and years." And then it goes on in the next verse, "And let them be for light, to give light upon the earth." Then it says, "And it was so." This is a phrase which is typically translated in all but the modern translations as "and it came to pass so." When did it come about and happen? After that he's describing, it's when it was all done. All the commands were completed. So what we've done here, and we're going to look at this phrase, vayahiken. I lost my track of thought. Vayahiken, "and it was so." Now, what does it mean? This one appears 9 times in the Bible. 6 of these are in Genesis 1, so we only have 3. And the operation of the verb vayahi indicates the presence of a time interval between events of prior verses, or prior in that verse, and the action or result subsequent to the verb vayahi. Now we can look at 2 Kings 15:12, and this is talking about Jehu. And Jehu is the person who succeeded in the northern kingdom after Ahab. And so the verse tells us, "This is the word of the Lord which he spoke to Jehu, in saying, your sons to the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel, via he can. And it was so," or the King James says, "and so it came to pass." But interestingly, there's a span of about 90 years here, from the time this was said to Jehu and the time at which his fourth son was temporarily on the throne of the northern kingdom. So the events that the words via he can, and actually I think maybe I need to, this is the via he, these four letters, and this is the can, which is the so. The words that via he can describe do not take place immediately. So it asserts completion, but not immediate completion. So now what we found is because of the completion that viahi is therefore driver's previous verb. So we've identified one of the criteria. Okay, now let's go forward again, and we have now let's look at this again, and we have in the and it was so. And then in the next verse, in Genesis 1:16, I have now translated it, "Now God had made the two great lights." And the word that's translated "made" is this word, and this, of course, is Elohim. So this is, "and God had," and God here, and then it goes back and says "had made," because of the word order. Now, so we're going to actually, we'll come back to this again, but what I want to go to is temporal overlay, because we were starting in the 1800s when I was quoting Driver, and now I'm going to quote Randall Booth in 1994. And this is the Summer Institute of Linguistics. And he calls this the problem of unmarked temporal overlay. And why it is a problem is as well known in the Hebrew, that many times they will use a pluperfect reference, but they will not change the style of verb. They'll continue with the style of verb that is used in a continuing story. And this has been called by other authors as dischronologizing. Well, if we look at this, what we see, he wants to know, how can we know this for certain? Some cases it's very plain because it is obvious. Sometimes it's not quite as obvious. So what he says, as we look at examples of this phenomena, we will notice two different ways in which the temporal overlay can be signaled outside of grammar. By outside of grammar, he means they have not put the subject first and the verb second. And that is because in Hebrew, normally in discourse, narrative, they will start with a verb and the subject will be second. And when they change the word order, this is a pluperfect indication. So he says one method is through the lexical reference and or repetition, and we will look at that. The other method is based on culturally natural somatic relationships. We will see a somatic relationship as well. He also states not every word should be repeated in order to provide a lexical signal. Now, there's a reason for that, because if you're going to add some additional detail, if you repeat identically all the same words, you have added no detail. So let's look at the verses. And this is an English translation. The first lexical reference is in the firmament of the heavens. It appears twice prior to verse 1:16. It appears once after verse 16. There is another reference, which is to give light upon the earth, which appears in Genesis 1:15. It appears in 1:17. So we have lexical reference in that case. There is another lexical reference. In Genesis 1:14, it says to divide the day from the night. But down in Genesis 1:18, it says to divide the light from the darkness. But that is a lexical reference. That's because Genesis 1:4, where God called the light day and called the dark night is established the somatic equivalence for the chapter 1 of Genesis. So now what I have is I have translated Genesis 1:16. Now God had made the two great lights, the greater to rule the day, the lesser to rule the night. Now the rule, which is a new quality, which he's introduced here, was not mentioned in Genesis 1:14 or 1:15. So the author of Genesis has added new information, the purpose. He also has at the end, and the stars also, which gets translated into the English, he made the stars also. So our question is, since God had made the two great lights, when had God made the two great lights? And for that, we're going to look at Job. In Job 38 is where God says to Job, "Job, you said a lot of things about me, and some of them were not right, so let me ask you some questions and we'll see how much you know." So here he is, and in 38:6, this is about the foundation of the Eretz, which is translated land or earth, and he asks this rhetorical question. He says, "Whereupon were the foundations thereof?" That's the foundations of the Eretz. "Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" And in 38:7, he says, "In the singing together of the stars of morning." And it's a different than the way it's translated here, but in the 38:7, it says, "When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." But the in the singing together is a way in which the Hebrew is telling you that 38:7 refers back to the rhetorical question of 38:6. So it tells us that the stars of morning were already there at the foundation. Well, but that tells us that that happened before Genesis 1:2. And why is that? Because in God's questioning, he then goes on to say, "Or who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it issued from the womb?" Now, of course, in Genesis 1:2, we have the world ocean. It's in darkness, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters. And then he goes on in 38:9 and says, "In my making the clouds the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band," which gives us the darkness and the clouds. And that is a reference and a qualifying thing to his rhetorical question in 38:8. So this places the additional asah, making of the sun and the moon, prior to Genesis 1:2. So what do we conclude? Well, it concludes that and God had made the two great lights is correct. It also, there are things that happen on in creative day 4. God sets them, give light upon the earth, divide the day from the night, and be for signs, for seasons, for days and years. But it told us via he can that this is done. So if it's years and they are done, it's much longer than 24 hours for the total interval of a creative time period. What does not happen in creative day 4? And God had made, or asah, because that's the word. What does it mean for the sequence of the creative times? Sequence remains. Now, this is different than the two-register framework view, because Klein, although he did recognize the pluperfect reference in saying that it referred to Genesis, the first creative day, had broken the sequence. So he did not have 6 days of creative action in sequence. That does not happen in this view. Now, the other question is, did the writer of Genesis consider the words bara and the word asah to be different or equivalent? Now, those who advocate a young earth advocate that bara and asah are interchangeable. And so let's look and see what the writer of Genesis tells us. And the writer of Genesis did not consider asah equal to bara. And we see that in Genesis 2:3. And it says, "And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made." Now, in if you look at the King James and the other English translations generally follow that, it says that God did both. He asawed. That's the creating. He barad, and then he asawed. The bara is the creation. The asaw is the making, or it's almost often translated in the Hebrew translations as do, some form of do. So God did something. And so now let's look at the second line in the Hebrew, which says, Shabbat, he had ceased from all his work, which bara, that's completed action, had created, God had created, to make or for making. So what does this mean for the fourth creative time? First, that God bara created, and subsequently God asaw, prepared, made, or did. And he did this by plan. He had intended to do something to those things that he had created. We aren't told what it is, but it's in written in here in Genesis. So what if one continues to claim that asaw is equivalent to bara? Well, in that case, the asaw is a lexical reference to bara. It refers to the creation of Genesis 1:1. And translate, if you want to do it, and had made, it means and had created. So now what's the issue here? Well, the issue is that those who advocate a 6,000 or 10,000-year-old earth need to drag Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 as instantaneously fulfilled actions of the first creative time period. Otherwise, the earth already exists. You do not get a young earth. And so they must assert that asaw and bara are equivalent. And they also then have to claim that God cannot asaw outside of a creative time period. And to do that, they go to the King James, which has an N in Exodus 20:11. And most English translations also have an N because they follow the King James, but they fail to italicize the N. The italicization says that that is a word which was added by the translators of the King James. And this continues into our English translations today, unknowing to most people don't know this. Young's literal translation, which is in late 1800s, he has it correct. It says, for 6 days, that's yoms, a plural, hath Jehovah made, a saw. He uses a saw. And if you look at the Hebrew, let me see here, you can see four, six of, yoms, the plural. Here's the asaw, which is not the bara. So the question is, if we look at it correctly, we find that yes, God had done both. He had barad and he had asawed, but he is not restricted from asawing outside of a creative time period. So now I'm probably using up most of my time here, so we'll have to rush a little bit. What it is that the word asaw, translated made, affirms additional details unknown to us about the preparation of the sun to rule the day and the moon to rule the night. Now, the English word made is also not equivalent to create. How many times did somebody make the bed at your house this week? So, now I have more information. I have a booklet. Well, it's on there, and there are a bunch of booklets over on the wall. And it's called Genesis 1 and the Age of the Earth. It is a booklet which I prepared to give a presentation to a homeschooling group because they were being advocated they had to believe in a young earth. And I was asked to have a presentation giving them another view. I also have a printout of a 3-page paper which covers this talk. And it's not the slides. It's written like a paper. And so I think that's about my time.
Okay, we're going to have the next speaker.